David, are you going to be willing to come down here for questions? Okay, good. We had a large group. It's a topic with which everybody is quite familiar. By that I mean James Ashton Miller and Dave Staskin and myself, we thought to set this up as four breakouts who met for 60 minutes each. James, do you want to come up here too? There was a lot of reminding ourselves that what we thought was going on in the mid-80s or even up until the 90s has changed quite a bit, and it's likely to change in the future. So it was phrased, what did we know, what did we not know, and what was going on right now and what was likely to happen in the future. And we're going to concentrate in this session on the future issues that we think are going to come up regarding the mechanisms of continence and surgical cure. And we're going to be covering both men and women, but largely focusing on women. We divided it into epidemiology and public health, pathophysiology, clinical diagnosis, treatment, and finally male and post RP urinary incontinence. So beginning with epi and public health, there's a perception that there's a large problem of hidden incontinence and that nobody really knows what threshold at which one should treat for stress incontinence. And if we decide to lower the threshold, that we go out and advertise and tell women you shouldn't be putting up with this, do we actually want all those patients entering the healthcare system, and who's going to pay for it if we encourage all these people to get earlier treatment? And likewise, if we defer treatment until later, is that spreading the burden just over to women and having to pay for pads? And we think it's going to be an increasing problem. We have an aging population. We're going to have four times as many 80-year-olds in the next couple of decades. And mixed incontinence is going to become more and more prevalent. And we are not very good at treating mixed incontinence. We don't really have an idea what's going to be coming up as we see the effects of obesity and comorbidities like diabetes. We probably need to understand a lot more about how at least those two conditions influence the treatment of stress incontinence. All countries seem to be having, to a variety of degrees, problems with knowing how to make best use of the available money. We had major questions about where we should be spending this money. It seemed like a lot of money was being spent on diagnosis, but it varies from country to country. Just countries that are right next to one another manage incontinence very differently. And it was interesting to ask if you had to reduce by a certain amount, which we think we're all going to be seeing reductions in our healthcare dollars, people would have dealt with that in a variety of ways. Finally, we, in terms of epi and public health, we really have not done a good job as a specialty trying to prevent stress incontinence. We really haven't made much strides in primary and secondary preventions, and maybe those of us who have tertiary referral practices maybe have thought a little bit about tertiary prevention, but these are big, huge studies that would have to be done. There are good reasons why we haven't done them. And we talked a little bit about enriching the study populations, maybe using people who are high-risk groups, family history, just studying obese patients, just studying low-pressure urethras, something to try to increase the chance that this person might develop the problem, might allow us to study smaller patient populations and thereby reduce the cost of doing prevention studies. For pathophysiology, we mostly just deferred to James Ashton Miller because he knows much more about pathophysiology of stress incontinence than most of us. But lots of big questions. How do we get rid of the artifact that we see in urodynamic studies of the urethra? Just the catheter and the lumen seems to affect so much of what we wish we knew, what we want to know. How do we get rid of the artifact that we heard Vic talking about that happens in imaging? What's the role of each of the layers and the function of the urethra? We know that there's an individual contribution both of sphincter and mobility. What's the relationship between the lower urethral closure pressures and the risks of developing SUI in the future? And what is it that contributes to urethral closure pressure? And it probably isn't just the hypermobility. And finally, what is it in the birth process that leads to an increase in stress incontinence? And the current hypothesis is that it's probably more likely to be urethral compression that's ongoing. Male stress incontinence, more research needed on post-radical prostatectomy urinary incontinence. We know little about the natural history of that incontinence. Prognostic factors, age, disease state, symptoms, and sphincter length, how these all impact the natural history of male incontinence, the role of urethral hypermobility in male incontinence, and to coordinate the ongoing international efforts that seem to already be up and running in RP and UI registries, at least in Europe. People were talking about that there were registries up and going, but how to make those so that they can interact with one another. In clinical diagnosis, the paradigm was that the bladder is an unreliable witness, so that led us to put a lot of faith and prize high-tech testing, but we really had very little evidence that urodynamic testing globally improved outcome. And in fact, people were talking about the NICE guidelines. It turns out that NICE recommends doing urodynamic testing for most people who are going to have their stress incontinence treated surgically, unless it's one of the very small subset of women who only have stress incontinence. And as most of us know, there aren't very many patients who only have stress incontinence. Yet the people who developed the NICE guidelines admit that there was really little data with which to back up that recommendation. So we'd like to see no further clinical tests recommended without that kind of outcomes-based evidence that it's going to make a difference in our treatment, and we should continue to subject our current clinical tests to that same standard. And finally, there needs to be more attention paid to clinical testing that predicts which patient will benefit from which treatments, who's going to benefit from conservative treatments, who's going to benefit from surgical treatments, and the unfortunate smaller set of patients who may benefit from none of the above. Finally, future directions in treatment. I think there was this consensus that the first surgical treatment is usually the most effective treatment, but now that we seem to be moving the threshold down to less bothersome stress incontinence because of the ease at which patients undergo some of the newer treatments, we may be seeing patients treated at a much earlier age or a much less bothersome time period. And if the first surgical treatment is the most effective and we know that subsequent treatments are less effective, are we actually going to see ourselves now in the next couple of decades having to treat patients over and over again? If we delay treatment, how would we do that? And isn't that just shifting the burden over to having to pay for pads? So that timing of where the threshold should be for treatment seems to have very little data to really inform our discussion, both amongst ourselves and with our patients. Reimbursements in most countries is not based on outcomes. So we can do a very poor job treating patients and we'll be paid the same as if we do a very good job. It seems like some sort of the healthcare dollar should have some sort of basis in how good our treatment outcomes are. Better understanding of what the patient wants from treatment. We think very little research has been done on this and that we'd like to see a lot more. And it often is so different from what the surgeon thinks the treatment outcome should be. And there's a need for physician-driven innovation rather than industry-driven innovation. We acknowledge that industry exists to make a profit. But if you limit all the new innovation in your treatments to techniques that are designed to yield a profit, then you may not be achieving the goal that most clinicians have, which is to improve patient care. So there was a lot of discussion about if the innovation comes from the physician scientist, that physician scientist still has to collaborate with industry to actually make it feasible and marketable. So so trying to meet the needs of both and trying to look more to physician-driven innovation. And some of the innovations that were discussed were actually incredibly simple. Staskin was saying, you know, if you inject saline into the bladder neck and that helps, or you inject blood into the bladder neck and that helps, that might be better at helping us predict who would benefit from a bulking agent. And finally, to concentrate on studies of our failures, to study the plane crash and try to figure out what happened that led to that systems failure has benefited the airplane industry, and it might be the best place for us to target our studies of how we can improve treatment. So that was a very quick rundown on what we did. We answered many, many questions, and that'll be all included in our larger description. So I'd like to open it up to questions now.
You've described a lot more than the topic of the think tank, in the sense that you know, the topic of the think tank is mechanisms of continence and surgical cure. You've gone way beyond that to epidemiology and new treatments. Was that because the actual topic was useless, or I'm interested that you extended your brief, which of course you had every right to do, very considerably. Was that because you felt the mechanisms weren't very interesting, or?
Well, we actually talked about trying to narrow the focus, but every time we tried to do that, and in fact, each of the little sub-think tanks all ended up discussing all of these as they tried to consider how best to treat stress incontinence. So although we tried to focus on treating stress incontinence, it ended up becoming a public health issue. It ended up becoming understanding the pathophysiology better. So it was attempted, and it just became a much more global issue.
So was James very frustrated by this?
James loved every moment.
He did. Okay, good.
So the truth of the matter is that I sent a list of very detailed pathomechanical questions to David, and got back quite a reaction from David.
He couldn't understand it.
But where we concurred was, and then Peggy chimed in, and where we concurred was, you know, we are looking ahead at 2020 and, you know, reduction in the amount of money that we've got to spend on treating patients. And so, you know, we have to, with our research, we're going to have to try to hone in on what really matters. And NIH, I'm sure the funding agencies in England are the same, and in Europe are only funding studies that have high impact. And so I guess that's how the topic got expanded.
I think my reaction to mucosal coaptation, smooth muscle function, and change in conformation with anatomic motion and shear forces, and so I said, my simple question response back was, if between behavioral therapy devices and midurethral slings, I can get, depending on your definition, 20, 40, 60, or 80% of people successfully treated, do I care anymore about who it is that's incontinent? Do I care anymore about why they're incontinent? Or do I care about even diagnosing who they are? As long as they leak, I'll just treat them. I said, because that's where we are. So I said, why don't we try to look at the factors that are actually affecting the treatment of continence rather than narrowing in on smooth muscle function again? Because everybody here has read those reviews, and we just end up with a paper that looked like a review of everybody else's work on this. And in the next 15 years, do we need to know more about that? Sure. And the answer was just yes. So we thought it might be interesting to look at it the way the ICI did, in a broader way, since the ICI Research Society, and say, if the population changes, what more do you need to know about how you're going to treat them? If the pathophysiology, you can't do it without understanding the pathophysiology. You need more accurate diagnosis, but we're not really using the diagnostic tools well that we have. So actually, it was a very, very loud room for one of these sessions, and everyone who was in every group really participated. So we thought it was a lot of fun. And we love changing, you know, your question. We just got an we were giddy. We were giddy when we got finished saying, oh, we're not going to do what Paul asked us to do.
Other questions, comments?
When you walk out the front door of the watershed, all you do is turn right and just keep going, and you'll see it 50 yards along on your right. If you turn left, you'll be in the water, so that's easy. Okay. And we're meeting there what time?
7:30 and 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.
7:30 and 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. And so tomorrow morning then, Gopal and Jenny, you're in here. Jean-Jacques, you're in two. And